a historic Brexit vote last week.
The result of the referendum is clear. However, its implications for the economy are not.
It unleashed a crisis in the financial markets, comparable in severity only to 2007-8.
It's clear that markets are volatile. There are some companies considering their investments, and we know this is going to be far from plain sailing.
And so uncertainty over the pace, breadth, and scale of these changes could weigh on our economic prospects for some time.
The fact is, it isn't Armageddon, it's actually quite the opposite. It's a new vision, it's a new horizon.
And in doing so, we now offer a beacon of hope to Democrats across the rest of the European continent. I'll make one prediction this morning. The United Kingdom will not be the last member state to leave the European Union.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It's amazing what happens in just a couple days. We began last week's program with a plunge in the markets globally as Britain voted to leave the UK. We saw stocks fall very quickly and sharply as the Dow lost over 600 points. That trend continued into Monday. Commodity prices fell. Oil went from 50 down to almost 45. Some of the winners were gold and bonds, and that continues on this week. But the difference, stocks are back up. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour on this holiday shortened week, as July 4th. It will be on this Monday. Joining me in the first hour will be Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. He's rather optimistic, believe it or not, on stocks. And you're going to want to hear why. He gives a very convincing case. He'll be joining me in the first hour. Robert Rapier will be here on energy. Robert's sticking to some his predictions made earlier in the year. He sees $60 oil by the time we get to December. But other than occasional spikes, oil's likely to trade to 50 to 60 in the next couple of years. He'll be joining me in the hour. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. At the end of last week, when we had the Brexit vote, you would have sworn the skies were going to fall. The end of the world was at hand. And then all of a sudden this week, the markets are back to normal. My. Did you ever think we were going to get such a bounce back? Well, yes, I did, as a matter of fact. But why did that happen? Is there anything fundamental to this? What we're going to do for the entirety of the big picture today is examine all of the ongoing considerations about the Brexit vote and where the future will lead, not just from a political standpoint, but also geopolitics and from a financial and economic standpoint. It's real clear that once again, we have passed through another watershed, another paradigm shift. And of course, right at the end of the week, the Daily Caller was the first site to release a report that the Department of Justice officials filed a motion in federal court on Wednesday seeking a 27-month delay in producing correspondence between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's four top aides and officials with the Clinton Foundation's and Teneo Holdings, and that's a closely allied public relations firm that President Bill Clinton helped launched. Now, where this is going to go politically, we don't know. It hasn't had enough time to surface. But where this is going to go is unclear as to whether or not it's really going to get messy or whether the fix is in. And Ryan Poplava, boy, what an exciting, what was it? I guess it wasn't only exciting last week since we had the Brexit vote on a Thursday. And of course, we were here on Friday. But then watching the market do what it did between Friday and Monday and then changing midweek. So from Brexit to Brentry, it looks like the market has really reconsidered recent events this week. What is your take on the market action? And then what does this spell out for the markets? I guess let's look at the near term to start with.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you remember, this goes way back, John, like 2008. There was an interesting interview with the Long Johns, if you've heard of them, a show back in the late 90s from the UK. They did just an interview concerning 2008, a phenomenal interview there about market sentiment. But, you know, I think it's largely explains with just frightening accuracy as to what just happened over the last week. Because I know a lot of our listeners are wondering.
Well, you have to remember two things about the markets. One is that they are made up of very sharp and sophisticated people these are the greatest brains in the world. And the second thing you have to remember is that the financial markets, to use the common phrase, are driven by sentiment.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, things, let's say, are just going along as normal in the market. And then, suddenly, out of the blue, one of these very sharp and sophisticated people says, "My God, something awful's going to happen! We've lost everything! Oh, my God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
Shall I jump out of the window?
Shall I jump out of the window? Exactly. Let's all jump out of the window.
Sell!
We've lost a
sell! Yes.
Precisely.
Yes.
Precisely. And then, a few days later, this same sophisticated person says, I think things are going rather well. And everybody says, I agree with you. I think we're rich. We're rich.
Yes. We're rich. Yes. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye, bye. Yes. And that's what we call market sentiment.
The voices of John Bird and John Fortune, the two Johns, in a very, very popular skit which airs on YouTube. The whole thing runs about 6 or 8 minutes, and it's an incredible satire on what we went through back in 2008.
John, the market investors on Tuesday took a look at just oversold conditions and looked at it as an opportunity and began buying. I think that once the S&P 500 closed back above the May low, which was around 2026, that was a technical signal that the move below that level on Monday was just a singular event and not the beginning of a downtrend. That level didn't hold to any kind of resistance on a rally. It helped that even though markets were down on Monday, another thing I noticed was the volatility index was down almost like 7% instead of up, which typically, that indicates that the correction was overdone and maybe some investors were taking their hedges off, maybe anticipating a rally right around the corner. So, the quality of the rally, that's one thing we should also take a look at is, okay, yes, we've rallied very strongly over a few days. What was the quality? It was great. Looking at just a broad swath of stocks in the S&P rallying to that. And, that's causing prices to rise back to the highs here. And, the Federal Reserve Bank's stress tests that came out this week and capital reviews, that also helped in helping the financials, which were just clobbered at the end of last week on the news, with interest rates falling as much as they did. And interest rates, as we know, fell because everyone was flying to safety, flying into bonds, flying into gold, flying to the US dollar. So the financials being the hardest hit, also rallying very strongly on that fundamental news. That was really I think one of few fundamental things I saw happening this week that really kind of justified the rally. Most of the rally was just, pure sentiment, pure technical.
All right, Ryan, but from perception, we've come through, Angela Merkel called it a watershed event. I think it's much more of a paradigm shift. But overall, despite the market's really impressive rally this week, has anything really changed, or are we wading out into some new waters here?
Yeah, no, John. And that's really the interesting thing, is that kind of answers the second part of your original question over, what's going to happen over the near term. As I mentioned last week, there were still a ton of unknowns and regarding the Brexit. And that was really the key factor of why the market was correcting as much as it was, is uncertainty. And that still remains. And I don't think at all that the market is discounting a lot of those unknowns that, how can it? If we don't know what's going to happen around the corner with, is Spain going to do a vote soon? Is Italy going to do a vote? Is somebody else going to leave the market? And that's just unknown. We can't know. The market can't know. So the market will fluctuate as those things start to unravel and unveil themselves. One thing I've mentioned often over the past couple of months is that sentiment is still very low. Positioning is such that there's a lot of cash on the sides, and that makes for these spectacular rallies. It's very easy for investors to jump in when they see these kind of dislocations, the market dropping 5% in 2 days, and then seeing some of those risk indicators drop, like the volatility index. So we definitely saw that happen. But on the flip side, we have high valuations, and there's a lot of fog surrounding global growth estimates. So how much upside is this rally going to really have in the near term? I don't think a lot. I think it's going to be hard to get above these levels that have been holding for 2 years now almost. I still believe we're in a sideways market. So yes, equity's got a nice punt back to the plus side, John, but we have to note we didn't see a corresponding sell-off in bonds while equity prices were going up. Rates are still staying low because it's still very quite clear from other economic news this week that the Fed is likely not going to step in here to raise for a while. And they can't because things aren't strong enough yet for that. And as investors with cash, you know, just sitting there burning in their pockets, if I am one of these people, do I jump into bonds after a big rally in prices? No. I jump maybe in equities after a 5% correction. And that's why I think the rally was so fierce. But at the same time, like I said, I think there's limited upside near term. You know, we've got to get through a whole bunch of hurdles first.
You know, Jim and I are going to discuss a lot of this on the big picture today. One of the things we were talking about off air here is the fact that the old will she or won't she may not be a point for the rest of the year now, given what's been going on, because the Fed may not do any raising given the situation of where we find ourselves now. So that remains to be seen, you know, for a while. What's also interesting is since we know that the European Union has to be notified under Article 50 by Great Britain to make it official. So now it's going to be, will they or won't they notify them? Because there is an advantage to Great Britain to delaying it. There's maybe an advantage to EU for speeding it up. You know, so now we don't just have one will they or won't they to watch in the near future. It's going to be all part of an interesting drama. All right. What economic news were you looking at particularly this week, given everything that was going on?
There was a few things that came out, and I'm not going to have a chance to see what's released on Friday. You know, we're here talking, John, on Thursday, heading out early tomorrow. But so I can't see what the manufacturing number is going to be for the week until we get to talk about it next week. So that's one thing I would want to be seeing, how that relates to what kind of results we get there. But personal income and the spending report was one major report that came out this week. And it showed basically spending was up about 0.2%. And that was less than what was expected, which was around 0.3%. The core price index. So if we're talking about some inflationary numbers, some of the numbers that the Fed watches showed that year over year, we're up 1.6% in the core price index. And that's the third time in a row that we've seen those results. So no real change there. Even without the Brexit, I don't think there was enough here to cause any concern for investors about any sort of Fed rate hike. And that's really what all we're doing is we're looking through that, the economic numbers right now through that lens.
Well, is there anything on the horizon that you think could serve as a catalyst which would move the market out of this trading zone?
Well, I think the manufacturing numbers, they've been falling for the past 6 months or so, and there's any change there. Retail sales numbers, which we got a few weeks ago, were really good. The labor, you know, the non-farm payrolls coming out next week on the 8th, that will be very key because such a major disappointment for the May numbers. And the market, you know, kind of went through a small hiccup there. If we get another really, really bad month, then maybe we could get that major summer correction that we got last year. You know, if the bears can really convince anybody that's jumped into this rally very over the short term, if those jobs numbers are bad, then that could really affect that. Also, I think just a bang up earnings season here, which will kick off on the 11th with Alcoa. You know, we've had two quarters now of declining overall earnings for the S&P 500. We want to see what happens in the second quarter. And that will kick off in just a week here. And then also at the end of that week, we'll get the banks, quite a few of them. And like I said, we got a real fundamental catalyst this week with those bank stress tests and the capital reviews by the Fed. And those we'll be looking at those that week as well. But yeah, it should be volatile in the weeks ahead. But you know, I don't think any of that will really stem for the Fed at this time. It's going to be earnings related, economics related at this point.
Yeah, I know, but life is just getting more and more interesting. Maybe there's a perverse sense of humor as a newsman. You know, newsmen have this very cynical sense of humor, and the worse things that get or crazier things get, the more they like it because there's something to talk about and it's sort of fun to watch. But anyway, okay, Ryan, have a very, very safe weekend, and next week we'll see if this Brexit thing carries out further. But now, obviously, rather than being as intense as it was over the last week, I'm expecting, tell me if you think I'm wrong, I'm expecting things will smooth out and become more time prolonged.
I totally agree. This is going to be a process, John, and we said that before the vote, still saying it after the vote. And I think if anybody on the bull side was jumping in here and buying, I think they probably knew that. You know, this is going to take time. It's not, you know, an imminent event that's just the end of the world here and go to cash over the next 2 years. I don't think this one little event is going to cause that sort of situation. So yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting.
And I want to wish everybody, first of all, Canada Day. Happy Canada Day. That's a belated Canada Day for our listeners. That's on July 1st. And July 4th is our Independence Day. That was the original Brexit, where we separated from Great Britain many years ago, July 4th weekend. So, Ryan, have a very safe and sane happy 4th.
And you too, John, and to our listeners.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Well, today we're joined with Brian Preddy. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Capital Planning Advisors. And Brian, one of the things I always like speaking with you is getting kind of a boots on the ground view, because you do so much with your clients in terms of meeting with them, doing account reviews. And a lot of your clients are large clients where, you know, they all own firms. And so you kind of get different insights into the economy. And if you will, I would like to lead off on, what are your clients saying? You know, they're various businesses. I know you've got some involved in housing and other areas. What are you getting from your take from your clients?
Chris, that's a great question. A little bit of anecdotal stuff. Ag industry. Things are starting to slow a little bit. And we've got, you know, a number of clients that are up in the Central Valley here who are doing a lot of international business. And they're starting to see it slow a little bit, Chris. I had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with a gentleman who owns his own winery in the wine business. And what he's telling me too, Chris, is just recently, what they've seen is people are starting to migrate toward lower price points. So, you know, as opposed to $20 and $30 wines, it's $15 and $20 or $10 and $15, you know, et cetera. So just a little bit of pressure on the consumer side. And at least for the moment, my wonderful super duper home perch here is the San Francisco Bay Area. And I grew up in the Bay Area. I've had a front row seat for what's kind of happened around here, and especially in San Francisco, which, as you guys know, is never land, you know, in terms of real estate prices and things like that. Chris, we're getting a little bit of anecdotal evidence that rents are starting to peak a little bit here in San Francisco. And likewise, some of the really high-end priced homes, we're seeing more in inventory. And the way it's been characterized by, you know, a number of the agents and the people in the businesses, the feeding frenzy is coming to an end. Still seeing growth, but, you know, the feeding frenzy is coming to an end.
Well, after a violent sell-off over Brexit, the stock market is back in a recovery mode. Was this a dead cat bounce or the beginning of something better? Joining us on the program from Vermilion Research is Dave Nikoski. Dave, you know, I'm looking at a weekly chart of the S&P 500, and it's really failed to go anywhere since, let's say, November of 2014. Some say this is just a sideways correction in time. What's your view here? Because we get up to that level, almost to new records, and then we fall back.
Excellent question, Jim. I think what we're seeing on our side is the markets are really being reactionary to what's happening in the currency markets for the last 2 years. If you looked at something like the U.S. dollar, for instance, you'd see that had a breakout up until the point, and it had been trending in an upward fashion up until roughly December of 2014. And since then, it has actually been sideways in a trading range. I think what's happening is we get these panics and we try to, you know, have attempts to break the dollar out to new highs or break it below to a new low. And it's not happening. And I think that the market is just gyrating, wondering what direction the dollar is going to take. And I think when you look back at history, one of the things that's prevalent when you look at climactic periods around the world, certainly the S&P has been less climactic with the exception of the sell-off back in the fall of 2015, as well as the more recent one here in February. One of the things that often happens, and you saw it on the Brexit vote as well, is everyone wants to head for safety, and they see safety in the U.S. dollar, and they see it in the Japanese yen. What's interesting here is despite the significant sell-off, the dollar, despite its rally, could not move out to new highs. And I think that, to me, is a good sign. If you look back at other periods like March of 2009, the U.S. dollar, despite the woes in the S&P and most of the financial contagion spreading mostly from U.S. banks within the mortgage industry, per se, you hit a new high in the dollar on March 6th as market or investors around the world gravitated to buy the U.S. dollar. And once you peaked out on March 6th and started the decline, you actually made the market lows on March 9th. And what we're looking here at Vermilion is we would like to see the dollar not break above the 96 level. We'd like it to take out the 93 level, but in a very slow, controlled fashion, not a capitulation like you've seen more recently on sterling. I think that would be helpful for the market. And any time that you've had that, where it's fear-based investing or seeking safety in the U.S. dollar or Japanese yen, once those trades start to unwind, the rest of the world is poised to move in a very northerly, very quick fashion relative to the U.S. markets. U.S. markets won't be hurt, but you're going to see more rotations take place into the cyclical sectors such as energy, materials, and manufacturing.
You know, one of the things that we saw the dollar begin to strengthen in 2014 when the Fed first announced taper, and then, of course, all last year, the Fed was talking about raising interest rates. Recently, especially with recent testimony in the March FOMC meeting on Capitol Hill, there's a big question now. The futures market is betting that probably the next thing the Fed might do is not raise, is actually lower. So do you think that a lot of the reasons the dollar was rallying are maybe no longer there, and that's why we're having difficulty?
I believe that everyone is second-guessing what the Fed's going to attempt to do. When you looked at December of 15, for instance, most of the experts out there, economists, strategists, came out with reports suggesting how many times and to what degree the Fed would be tightening. By the time we rolled into January, February, it was, oh, any rate increase is going to be not occurring within the first 3 months of the year. And pretty soon everyone started sliding out any rate increases towards the end of the year. The market right now is not pricing in one. And I think that Yellen probably said the best thing that she could have said, and that is wait until we see some signs that we're seeing inflation or jobs pick up in the U.S. I think what she's doing is waiting for the market to decide when to raise rates. And we're going to see that once we start seeing investors exit what I would say is a bond bubble, and we can stay in a bond bubble for a lot longer than anyone thinks. When you're investing in sovereign debt around the world that has zero or negative interest rates, it absolutely tells you that the policies have failed of the central banks around the world. It's absolutely nonsense to invest a dollar and get 99 cents back by any investor for a long period of time. So again, that can last a lot longer than most people think. And until we see investors sell the bonds off, I think we can continue at this rate for a long time.
Yeah, it was amazing because a lot of technicians and some, even on the fundamental side, thought the bond market peaked in the summer, whether it was 2012, where the yield got down to 1.4 something. And Dave, Thursday night with the ruckus after Brexit, we got down to 1.42 on the 10-year treasury. So when you think that rates can't go any lower, as you just mentioned, they did. If you take a look at British gilts, we're at the lowest interest rate in the entire history of the Bank of England since it was established in 1694. So where is money going to go, I guess, is one question. You don't want to put your money and loan money to a government and then you get back less than you gave them. So there's that. And then the second one is, do you think one of the props on the stock market is I can go into, let's say, a sovereign bond and either get negative interest rates or a 1% rate, or I can go into a stock and maybe get a 2-3% dividend and a consumer staple, 4% in utilities, and heck, even a telecom that may pay 5%.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And again, I think that all of that is actually going to be controlled by the dollar. What you're suggesting and what you're indicating here is the reaction of investors until the dollar breaks one way or another. Because if we start to see the dollar fall, what we're going to have is we are going to have a rise in inflation. Then your Fed is definitely going to raise rates. I think that's a higher likelihood of taking place, is that the dollar is going to drop. With all the turmoil we've seen in the market over the last 6 months, the dollar has not hit a new high. That's a bearish sign to me. I would say I'm probably one of the few out there that over the last 6 months have been calling for a dollar top. And I don't mean it's an ugly top or it's the end of the world. I think that what we're seeing is so many emerging markets have been decimated. And if the U.S. dollar were to come through the 93 level, I think you're going to see a flood of money move into those emerging markets.
When we saw the sell-off last Thursday night, Friday, and Monday, it was worse overseas. The U.S. held up relatively well, if you look at the damage that was going on in Europe and Asia. A lot of that damage, I know, with emerging markets has been a result of the dollar. So if the dollar does ease and decline gradually, as you say, that lifts some of the burden off emerging markets. Do you think that's the next rotation?
I think you're already seeing it. If you looked at the Shanghai post-Brexit decision, they actually traded up. They were one of the few markets around the world that was not fazed by it. Brazil held up extremely well relative to the rest of the world. Even if you looked at the UK on their equity side, in local currency there, they held up much better than the rest of the continent. However, the sterling did get hit hard, so if you're a foreign investor in the UK market, you certainly felt like you got bludgeoned with a club. I think that what that would suggest is not many foreign investors actually held stocks enough to sell them down. And I would say that this is probably a vote that short term is going to create panic, but in the long term, it's going to give them better autonomy on how to spend and create fiscal policy within their own government.
So as we assess the way things are, interest rates have been heading down. In fact, they've gotten lower. The stock market has bounced back. I don't think we've approached those levels that we saw last August and September. We've got dividend yields higher on stocks, which make them more attractive. And of course, Dave, if the dollar does go lower, that should ease some of the burden on multinational companies that make up the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which have been hurt by a stronger dollar.
Absolutely, and I would concur with all of that.
Let's talk about the commodities market. If eventually the dollar declines and we get more reflationary efforts, the swap lines that have opened up with the Fed, the swap lines that have opened up with the Bank of England, they were ready to basically print as much as $250 billion in pounds. Then when you take a look at that, let's talk about commodities, because oil pulled back. It's still in the high 40s. It's no longer in the 20s as it was in February. And on the day you and I are speaking, which is a Wednesday, we still have a strong movement in gold above 1300. Let's begin with gold. What's your take on gold here and the gold stocks?
I think gold is entering a secular bull. That's been our opinion for a while. You broke multi-year downtrends in gold. Again, if you look at the backdrop of why is gold working, you got zero, you got negative interest rates. You know, most of these sovereign debt around the world is backed by the full faith issuing government. It begs one to question, if they are backed by those sovereign governments, what is their currency? What we're seeing, I think, is the turmoil in the currency, for instance, is you're having moves that would normally take years are happening overnight in their currencies. And again, one has to question the validity of negative interest rates or zero interest rates. And I think that's falling over to the currency. So going back to the question of the commodity structure, I think that we are in a bull market in commodities across the board. I think they're going to do much better than most people think. If you had to bring a fundamental aspect or look back at another period of time, I think the perfect example is looking back at 1998 and looking at the failure of long-term capital, looking at the Thai baht and how that, or the Asian contagion as they called it at the time, how that roiled the markets. And I think you have much of the same going on, where you had at that time oil went down to $10 a barrel and every magazine that hit the newsstand came out and indicated that oil would be at $10 a year for the next decade. That lasted about 3 years, Jim, and you started a secular bull market in the fall of 2001 that was post the technology bubble collapse. I think that we're going on a repeat. I think so much capital is dried up going into the energy industry You know, I saw a number, and it's fundamental, but we always try to pull some fundamental data to at least support what we're seeing technically. But we've seen the lowest amount of oil finds going back to the late 60s in the last year. Well, that's because capital is dried up. No one's searching for it. It'll come back to haunt us in a couple of years, more than likely.
Is it possible, when you say we've begun a new bull market, is it possible, Dave, that we got up to $50 on silver and got up to $1,900 on gold, that we could take out those old highs?
I think it's a high possibility, especially when you look at how much money is being printed around the world. You know, the problem is, as technicians, we always try to find a period in time that's like this. You know, the only example that we can find of a low interest rate environment such as this, you look back at the 50s in the U.S., late 40s, early 50s, Japan, they collapsed in 89 and had very, very low interest rates relative to the rest of the world since 1989. And I guess it begs the question, I heard comments from some very well-known investors, as the Fed came out and said that we were going to have low interest rates for 100 years, the Dow would be up to 100,000. It's not going to happen. Look at what Japan did. They still have not taken out their 89 highs. So I think the fear, the risk, we don't have a risk-free rate anymore. It's actually negative. You have greater risk buying government bonds than you do stuffing it in your mattress.
Given this, and we saw the safety rotation last week, as you look at the various sectors, what is looking strong to you right now? Would you stick with things like materials and energy, precious metals, if we indeed are in a new bull market for, let's say, commodities?
Yeah, our overweights are mainly energy, materials, manufacturing. And again, the manufacturing side is more of the belief that the U.S. dollar is going to continue the gradual decline that we've seen over the last 6 months. We are overweight in technology. There's some significant bases there. If you looked at many of the semi companies, they're actually gorgeous bases looking at 10, 20-year charts. We do believe that that will continue to be a leadership. We're underweight financials. We recently did a tactical overweight in utilities. We had originally upgraded that in January and brought that down in April, thinking that most of the damage, or at least the upward move in utilities, would probably dissipate. I think that, again, this is more of a panic-driven market where you're forcing investors into the dollar, into treasuries, into staples, into utilities. I think that we're going to do just fine. But again, what you're seeing in the market is kind of like watching a Ferrari 12-cylinder engine. And as you're racing down the highway, someone's pulling out a spark plug from each cylinder as we move. And the representation there would be such that each cylinder is a sector. And so you're getting upward thrusts in a sector for 3 to 4 weeks, and then it dissipates and comes back in, and money goes back into a different sector. So it's very difficult when you look at, as much as you started the call out with, is that the markets move sideways, essentially, for the last 2 years. Therein lies the problem of what is long-term leadership. I think we will get a better understanding what true long-term leadership will be if the dollar breaks above 96 or breaks below 93.
So, Dave, as we look at this, and you and I have been in this market for decades now, have you ever seen a period like this where you have such rapid rotations? They call it the risk-on, the risk-off trade. And we seem to flip back and forth with that trade throughout the year. Have you ever seen rotations like this in your lifetime?
The only times that I've seen rotations like this, looking back at our data, was historically you get very fast rotations on a sector basis post a secular bear market low. So, for example, after the December lows of 74, one of the things that you had take place is, and again, we are a group where it goes back to that time period, investors rotated and drove up sectors one by one, where it was very difficult to tell what long-term leadership was. But every sector went up post that 74 low, but it went in fits and starts, such that you'd have a sector advance for 4 to 6 weeks, and then you'd have it dissipate anywhere from 30 to 50% of its gains, and the money would move to another sector. Those are the only periods in time when one looks back at relative strength, which is what we stress the most in our group, and that's where most of our work takes place. The other time that you've seen that same exact pattern was post the 2009 lows. Once you made the 09 lows, it was very fast sector rotations, but no sector hit a new low, but all of them were jumping from lily pad to lily pad in terms of sectors. So this has the feeling of what I would refer to in history as a post-secular low, but we're not really at a low. And what may be happening, Jim, is that we're retesting the lows in a number of sectors, whether it's consumer cyclical, whether it's the financials. If you pulled up a chart of Bank of America, it is possible that we have two different markets. We have a bull market in the safety areas, kind of the barbell approach in terms of bonds going from long-term to short-term. But what we have is we have kind of a barbell approach. You need something of safety, but you also need growth. And if you look at something like the Russell 2000 versus the S&P 500, the Russell 2000 is still outperforming the S&P. And so you do have this growth aspect, but you have utilities and staples hitting new highs.
Absolutely amazing. Well, listen, Dave, given where we are right now, we always tell people, and I'm sure you would give the same advice, whenever you have sharp reactions, as we saw on Friday and Monday, don't react to that. Panic, I mean. And sometimes these short, brief, fast and furious corrections offer some opportunities to pick up on things that maybe you wanted to buy. Now you can get them at a cheaper price. I mean, you just take a look at what happened to the financial sector in the last 3 or 4 days. So anything that looks attractive as a sector to you, is there something that stands out if you were to say, boy, this looks cheap, I ought to put some money there? Technically on the charts, the patterns look good.
Well, if the commodities are any indication that the dollar is likely to weaken, which I believe it is, I would say that the manufacturing sector, with the hit that they've taken just over the last 2-3 days, many of them have pulled back to the 200-day moving average. And names, you know, in there would be, you know, for instance, an Illinois Tool Works, Ingersoll Rand, your GE, your 3M has taken a decline, but it's hitting relative strength highs. I mean, those are the types of things that you want to see hold up well in a market where they don't take out support levels. I would say the energy stocks look absolutely terrific, and Apache, your Chevron, your Exxon, many of your high-paying dividend ones. Again, you get into the question if the dollar does decline through the 93 level, and that's using U.S. dollar index, which I'm not a huge fan of because it hasn't been adjusted since 1973. There's a lot that's taken place in the world since 73, but it's something that investors look at, so therefore we have to look at it. A trade-weighted dollar would be the preferential index to look at. So I think there is a great deal of opportunity out there, and I think that we're going to wake up and realize that the sun will rise another day and we'll see the moon the following day. That's a guarantee for me. And the world's not over. I think what we're seeing is an anti-establishment move around the world, and I don't think that that's happened for a heck of a long time. And I think this is something that we will get over.
Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at Vermilion, how could they do so, please?
Our website is at vermilioncap.com, and it's 1L in Vermilion. Otherwise, they can feel free to give us a call. Our number is 952-922-7500.
Dave, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a nice holiday weekend.
Thanks, Jim, and you have a great weekend as well.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on Lifetime Income this week is Jo Robinson. She's the author of a new book, Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. And Joe, you know, most of what we see in the supermarket today comes from large commercial farms, local farms, and some of us have backyard gardens. But in your book, you talk about thousands of years ago, we began to alter what it is that we eat, growing those things that we liked, that tasted well. But in the process, we're missing a few things. Explain that.
Yes, we had no idea what we were doing, but as soon as we became farmers and stopped eating wild food exclusively, which we did for most of our evolution, we began selecting plants to grow in our gardens that were sweet. You know, we looked at all of the wild plants and found ones that were sweet, put them in our gardens, ones that had fewer seeds and thinner skins and grew more rapidly and had more starch. And, you know, these were logical choices to make. But only now, I'm talking in the last 15 years, do we know that in making all of those choices based on convenience and flavor, productivity, we were getting rid of a lot of nutrients. And the most important ones were these phytonutrients, which are compounds that plants make to protect themselves from the environment, Now we know that those very same compounds protect us from disease. In fact, all of our major diseases today, heart disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, and dementia, all of those things, we could reduce the risk of them and the rate of them if we could restore some of those phytonutrients that we have bred out of wild plants over 400 generations.
Well, after a brief drop, oil prices are back on the rise again. Since hitting a low in February at $26 a barrel, here we are at close to $50 again. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, we had a quick sell-off of commodities, with the exception of gold, on Friday and Monday, as there was growing concern that a Brexit would weaken economic growth, and so therefore the oil market sold off. But as we are speaking here on this Thursday, we've got oil prices right back up, approaching close to $50 a barrel. But if you look at a chart of oil since February, it's been going up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote an article in the wake of this this British vote. I said, look, Britain's oil production and their oil consumption they're pretty low, and the EU as a whole is pretty low, and it's been falling. And so I don't expect this to have a major impact. Overall, the oil markets are being driven by developing countries, and I just don't see this vote having a long-term impact on, that's assuming that Britain actually goes through with it and does exit. I just don't see it having a big impact on the oil markets. I think it's a little bit of a fear of was the reason for the sell-off. And, you know, we actually recommended that people take advantage of this as a buying opportunity. People who had missed out on the run-up in oil and gas price, you know, there may be some bargains, and we actually did put out a buy order on something we considered a bargain in the wake of the vote, and that was BP. We recommend that BP had sold off more than they should have, and in fact, they popped back up 5%, I think, yesterday.
Robert, as we look at this oil market since February, over the last probably 15 months, we've seen the rig count drop, and we know eventually that would catch up with oil production. Oil production is down, 500,000-600,000 barrels, and we're expected to go down from 9.6 to 8.6. But recently, with the price of oil going back up over 50, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about Gulf oil production is ramping up, which is surprising because it's more expensive to produce oil offshore. And also the rig count has been climbing lately, not by much, but it's climbing again. So could we get in a situation where if the price of oil stabilizes between, let's say, $50 and $60 a barrel, you could see shale oil start to come online, and also, as we're seeing now, Gulf of oil start to ramp up as well?
Yeah, I said that I think there's a bit of a resistance probably at about $60, because as you get closer to 60, you have a lot of these drilled uncompleted wells that are going to go ahead and be completed and come online. But at the same time, you know, they can't do this overnight, and there is a chance, and I've said that the longer you stay low, below a sustainable price, the more you're likely to overshoot to the high side. So I think in the long term, and for a few years, probably $60 is going to be a good price that oil producers can make a little bit of money, and it will incentivize enough production to satisfy demand. But, in the short term, we could see a little bit of a shortfall as we overshoot, because there may be too much production that is shut in and demand is continuing to march on. I mean, we had strong demand growth last year, forecast strong demand growth this year. And so I think we will start to cut through some of those inventories that have built over the last couple of years. And we could see, you know, a little bit overshoot to the high side. But I think we won't see $100 oil again for a while. You know, $60 is probably a good price. I predicted in January that we'd see $60 by the end of the year. I think that's still a very good possibility that we will do that. But we'll see. We've still got a lot of inventory overhang that has to go through.
You know, let's talk about the longer-term prospects. One thing that really surprised the oil market and switched it from pessimism to almost fear was what happened to the Canadian oil sands. That fire took a million barrels offline. What's going on in Nigeria, where almost 800,000 barrels have been taken offline. So it goes to show you, Robert, how fragile, despite the increase in production, the oil markets are. So you have something like a Canadian fire or something happen to a major exporter like Nigeria,
and it completely flips the market around. So it shows how vulnerable it is. But let's talk about something that happened over the last 2 years, and especially with Western oil companies. Several hundred thousand workers have been laid off. Drill rigs have been idled, and a lot of expenditures for new leases and drilling activity has come almost to a halt. Now, sooner or later, that is going to have some impact on the market. So any company like Exxon or whatever oil company that's out there, they're not replacing their reserves. They've been laying off workers, and they've cut back on exploration and finding new leases. Sooner or later, that's going to catch up with the markets.
Right, and that's the short-term risk of a little bit of a spike in prices here. You know, at $50, I think a lot of companies are starting to look out a little bit further and say, you know, it's time to start maybe hiring a little bit more. I think some people are starting to hire again, and some people have an eye on the oil price now with an eye to, you know, growing production a little bit now, maybe if oil price is a little bit higher. But as you say, it won't happen overnight. So, you know, there is a possibility in the short term that we see a little bit of a shortfall, which could spike prices up above, you know, $60 in the, you know, over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months. But I think it'll settle down a little bit, because I think there's enough companies that can make money at $60 that you will see, you know, some supply side response.
So in the next couple of years, if you were looking out, you think oil prices will stabilize in the $50, $60 range with maybe occasional spikes if something happens, a hurricane in the Gulf that takes down supply, or who knows, some kind of event in the Middle East as we're seeing, or in Africa as we're seeing in Nigeria?
Yeah, if I have to look out over the next 2 to 3 years, I would guess that we'll probably average about $60. That's what it looks like to me, looking at the supply-demand situation today. But you know, there is a risk in the short term that we do have a little bit of a shortfall, and we spike over that. But I think probably we average 60. I think that's a good sustainable price over the next 2 or 3 years, looking at the supply-demand situation that the way it looks today.
Robert, I want to talk about something, not just fundamentals. The U.S. is in the middle of a presidential election, and there's two opposing views on the candidates. One would be free markets, let's exploit our natural resources. The other one is a green agenda, which could come in play with the Clinton administration following basically what Obama's done. We've seen the coal industry decimated as a result of environmental laws, and there's a movement against fracking. What, in your opinion, would change in the energy markets given a change in politics? Let's say Hillary Clinton is our next president, a continuation of Obama's green policies. How would that affect the energy industry?
Well, I think we've got to look at fracking, for instance. I think Hillary signaled that, and by the way, in my predictions for 2016 at the beginning of the year, I did predict she would win the election. Not any endorsement of her, just I looked at the candidates and I said, ultimately, people are going to probably decide they can live with her more than they can live with some of the other candidates. So I think we will see her win the election. So I think we will see some continuation of Obama's policies. Now, Bernie Sanders forced her to the left during the primaries. She got more aggressive against fracking, where in the past she's been a little more supportive. She was forced to take a position against the Keystone XL pipeline, which before she had supported. So, you know, one thing is whether she's going to sort of stay to those positions as she, you know, if she wins the election. I think fracking is something that we're not going to realistically ban. I mean, we get most of our gas now from fracking. We get most of the new oil that's coming online is coming from fracking. So that's something that would really cut us off at the knees if we went and banned fracking. The coal industry, I've always looked at that as a little bit different matter, because we have a lot of different ways we can make power. And so coal being the having the highest carbon dioxide footprint per megawatt of power production, there are a lot of different ways we can replace that power. And one's natural gas, and that's happening now. Of course, that's being done by fracking. You have renewables coming online, and you've got potentially nuclear power also that can all replace coal. So I think the coal industry is still going to be in trouble. You know, I don't know if Trump won, what it would mean for the coal industry. I think there's still a lot of momentum in around the world in getting the carbon dioxide emissions down. I think there'll continue to be pressure there. But, you know, I don't see much happening. There may be some more regulations on the fracking business, but realistically, even if Bernie Sanders had won, realistically, fracking was not going to be banned. That would never have been allowed. The Congress would have never allowed that because of what it would have done to our domestic oil and gas production, and with no way to replace that production.
Well, if we take a look at the other sources of power, I know in my own state of California, we've shut down both our nuclear power plants. Realistically, what are the chances for nuclear power after Fukushima? There seems to be a sort of a backlash against nuclear power. And I'm only aware of maybe one or two power plants that are being built in this country. So how realistic is it to think about nuclear power since it's a long-term, a big construction project?
You know, it all depends. If you look around the world, nuclear power did increase last year, and it's been coming back since Fukushima. China grew at double digits. Their nuclear power consumption increased by nearly 30% last year. So, you know, especially in the developing countries, they're either going to develop on coal or they're going to develop on nuclear power. Now, if we have choices, if we have better choices and options, and we do, we've got natural gas. If not for natural gas, you'd be seeing a lot more pressure to build nuclear power plants in the United States. But, you know, we've got the luxury of all this natural gas, and so there's not been as much pressure in the U.S. I'm just checking the U.S. numbers. Our nuclear power production was the same in 2015 as it was in 2014, which is up a little bit over the previous year. And, you know, if I scan, we're about the same as we've been over the past decade. We're still, you know, we're near the peak. We hit a peak nuclear power production in 2010. We're maybe a couple of percent below that. So we're still producing a lot of nuclear power in the U.S., and there are many, many reactors being built around the world, especially in China.
So as we look at this industry, a possible replacement for coal would probably be the likely candidate would be natural gas. Let's talk about the price of natural gas. Where do you see that going? Because, you know, it got hammered pretty hard. Do you see that coming back as oil has from, you know, when we got down to $26 a barrel, where, you know, oil prices have basically have doubled since then? What about natural gas?
Yeah, I've been telling anybody who would listen, I've written a number of articles this year when natural gas prices were at $2 that there's no way that this price is sustainable. And when natural gas was $2, I gave a presentation in Las Vegas in May, and I was asked the question, you know, okay, you make the case that natural gas is underpriced, what would you buy? And I said, well, I'd buy some natural gas companies. I said, if you really want to be risky, I said, you can go out and buy UGAZ, which is the three leveraged natural gas futures ETF. And that's now up over 100% in the last month because natural gas prices have finally started to rally. If you look over the last 20 years, anytime natural gas prices dip below $2.50, they more than doubled within 2 years, every time. And so, you know, natural gas prices at $2 are going to discourage production, and they're going to encourage consumption, and they are encouraging more power switching. So there was no way that it was going to hang around at $2. In fact, the Money Show at the beginning of 2016 asked me for stock picks, and one of the ones I gave them was EQT. I said, that's a natural gas producer. Natural gas is undervalued. And they contacted me this week and said, that's one of our top picks for the year, up 52%. Year to date. So the natural gas companies are starting to rally. Natural gas prices have started to rally. Now, at nearly $3 now, I think there's a little bit of a risk of a pullback because natural gas inventories, like crude oil inventories, are very, very high. And natural gas prices in the short term are always a little bit of a weather prediction. If we have a hot summer and a cold winter, natural gas prices go higher. There's more of a call, there's more of a demand on utilities to supply natural gas. So in the longer term, though, I think natural gas prices above $3 are sustainable. There are many, many demand drivers with the utility switching, with LNG export terminals being built, with chemical manufacturing renaissance in the U.S. There are many drivers that should push natural gas prices on up to probably the $3 to $4 range. But in the short term, if summer moderates soon, you could see a pullback. So I would be a little cautious with natural gas now. You don't have the same upside that you had, you know, 2-3 months ago.
So if you look at the energy sector, and as we talked about earlier, there's been a substantial drop in investment. You know, the major oil companies, I think in 2015, only replaced about 70-75% of their reserves. How long is it before we start seeing more substantial, let's say, buyouts or mergers? Because these companies, if you're a big company like Exxon, BP, Royal Dutch, Total, whoever you are, and you're only replacing 70% of your reserves, you know, eventually you're going to go out of business unless you drill for new oil to find more oil, more natural gas, or you go out and buy somebody.
Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't happened already, but I think there are a couple of things. One is that, Exxon made a big acquisition a few years ago with XTO. Shell made a big acquisition last year. So some of the big guys are digesting some very large purchases at the moment. They want to be very confident that we're out of the woods with respect to low oil prices. They want to know that if they go out and make an acquisition that it's going to start paying off here in the next, couple of years. So, but I'm expecting it. I'm expecting there to be some acquisitions. Some of these guys are sitting on some cash. Some of them have been burning through cash, and they will need to probably see maybe a little bit higher oil prices and a little bit of confidence that they will no longer burn through their cash reserves before they feel confident in going out and making a purchase. But, there are some cheap companies out there right now.
So as you look at the oil sector, I don't care whatever chart you look at energy, if you're looking at the big companies, mid-tiered companies, natural gas, or even the small-tiered companies, they've all had a nice run since those lows reached in February, and those runs continue. What looks best from you if you were looking at a sector, or if you were looking at, let's say, large cap, mid cap, small cap, what looks most attractive here?
It depends. I mean, if you look at the different sectors, like in the big upstream, I mean, the big integrated oil companies, I think BP looks pretty good. BP, I think, had oversold with the exit vote last week. I think they haven't had the same sort of rally as some of the other companies have, some of the big guys have. So BP looks good. In the midstreams, some of the midstreams have lagged a little bit. The Alerian MLP index, which represents most of the midstream MLPs, has rallied by 50-something percent since the lows of February. Not all the MLPs have rallied like that. So, I'd be looking around at some of those guys that maybe have lagged. Magellan Midstream was another pick that I made back in January. It is up, in fact, let's see. It's up about 12% year-to-date, which is, that's lagging. I mean, it's performing well relative to the market, but relative to its index, I'd say it's lagging a little bit. There are a few companies like that, but frankly, I've been looking a little bit outside of oil and gas lately. Some energy companies, but outside of the oil and gas sector, I've been finding a few more bargains. Enviva Partners is a biomass pellet producer, and they ship pellets into the European market, and they're growing by leaps and bounds. They're a master limited partnership, and they IPO'd a year ago, and they're now the number one, year over year, the number one MLP among all the MLPs. So they're outperforming all the midstream MLPs. And I've been investing lately. I bought for my own portfolio Solar Edge, which makes solar PV inverters. So even within the energy sector, there's a lot of places that, you can look around and find bargains, not necessarily in oil and gas producers, a lot of which have rallied already. I'd be looking at a bit of a pullback for some of those guys, because some of them may be a little bit ahead of themselves at the moment.
Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Yeah, the best way is I write weekly columns for Investing Daily, and I have a subscription column there. So if you want particular buy-sell advice, that's where you can find it. I also write a weekly column for Forbes, and that's just general energy sector things, not specific for investors, but overall what's happening in the energy sector.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Have yourself a great weekend and a holiday.
Thanks, Jim. Anytime.
Now, you would have sworn after the Brexit vote last week, seeing what the markets did on Friday immediately after the vote, and on Monday as well, that the entire world was coming to an end as a result of what was going to happen, that the global economy would never, ever bounce back from it. But by midweek, the markets were acting like nothing had happened. Well, what are the broader implications of all of this and of the Brexit in the future, since this is a fundamental paradigm shift, a watershed event? We'll talk about all of that, the causes for the bounce back, as well as the future, coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.